Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Science writer Bethany Brookshire has an enemy who lives in her backyard. His name is Kevin.
Kevin. His full name is, I guess you could say, Freakin' Kevin. But we call him Kevin for short.
Kevin is a gray squirrel.
To be clear, there's probably about 12 of him in the backyard. I just call all of them Kevin. And he is my mortal enemy because due to this squirrel or group of squirrels, I have not had a successful tomato garden in at least 5 years. He steals all of my tomatoes every single year.
Annoying as Kevin the tomato thief may be, Bethany says squirrels are an interesting case study in terms of our relationships with wild animals. They are everywhere now and quite the nuisance, but squirrels weren't always this abundant in our backyards or cities.
They were actually pets. People would trap squirrels and keep them as pets, and every so often one would escape and it would make the news. There's a squirrel in Manhattan, it escaped.
Then, at the end of the 19th century, cities started creating more parks and green spaces.
And squirrels were actually brought in deliberately to urban centers and released to kind of give people a little sense of wildlife and a little bit of nature near their apartments in their urban lives. And of course, now there's plenty enough food to sustain squirrels, and they have multiplied. And now we have many, many squirrels.
So many of them that we often refer to them as pests. How did we get from cute animal with a bushy tail to vermin we loathe? Bethany gets into those kinds of questions in her new book, Pests: How Humans Create Animal Villains.
We think of pests in the same way we think of weeds. Weeds are plants that are out of place. And pests are animals that are out of place. But that then begs the question, who determines what an animal's place is? And the answer to that is, we do. Pest is a very subjective term for an animal that bothers us, an animal that is doing something we don't think that animal should be doing. The animals themselves are just doing what they need to do. They're just living their lives, you know? They just happen to be eating my tomatoes. And it's my perception that turns a squirrel that other people might really love into a pest.
Bethany says we can rethink our relationships with these vilified animals. On today's episode, from squirrels to rats, pigeons, and pythons, what makes a pest? We'll talk to Bethany about her book, hear from a mosquito researcher who actually likes mosquitoes, and explore one man's epic battle with an especially creepy sea creature. Let's stick with Bethany Brookshire. In her book, she argues that pests are often a problem of our own making, and what we call a pest or not is all about context. Take pigeons, for example. Like squirrels, they are everywhere in cities. Their poop is all over the place. We associate them with filth. But Bethany loves them. She says they are her favorite.
They highlight our own hypocrisy so well. because the reality is that every pigeon in America, every pigeon in Europe, every pigeon pretty much anywhere except the Middle East, is there because we brought it there. Because we used to value the pigeon. We domesticated the pigeon around 5,000 years ago, and we did it because pigeons are delicious. Their poop makes excellent fertilizer. And pigeons have this amazing thing they do, which is they go out from their roost every day, they eat, and then they go exactly back to where they came from. Pigeons do not get lost. So they made great food, they made great fertilizer, and they made excellent messengers. And we bred these animals and valued them for millennia. And then we developed the telephone and chemical fertilizer and chicken, and the pigeon lost its value. And it's really fascinating to see over time as the pigeon lost its value, it continued doing what the pigeon has always done, right? It went out, it fed itself, it came back home. But now we have no use for them, and now we hate them. And it's so sad. We've built an environment that's perfect for them, right? We put out trash. We put out bird seed. We have beautiful curlicue limestone sculptures on our roofs that pigeons love to roost in. We have created an environment that is perfect for them, and we're mad that they're taking advantage.
In another example in Bethany's book, she writes about an animal that's usually hated, but is elevated to special status in a unique setting. You describe a temple in India that is home to thousands and thousands of rats. How are the rats treated there?
Yeah, so this is an interesting example of the fact that some animals that we might think of as pests, such as rats, in this case, the black rat, Rattus rattus, are not pests everywhere, and they're not pests to everyone. But yes, this temple, the Karni Mata Temple, it's in Deshnuk, India. So the interesting thing about this temple is that these rats, the worshippers of these rats, are not worshipping rats. They are worshipping humans that have been reincarnated into the bodies of rats. And so that's what's really fascinating, is that these rats are not seen as rats. They are not seen as pests or vermin. And when I talked to some of the worshippers at that temple, I said, oh, well, you know, does this change what happens if you see a rat in your kitchen? And one of my sources said, oh, I hate rats in my kitchen. They're absolutely disgusting. So it's about context. The rats in the temple are not rats. They are reincarnated people. The rats in his kitchen, those are rats. And those are pests. And it shows how these animals are pests only as a matter of context.
And I'm looking at pictures, and they have these bowls, and they are just like sitting there and drinking what looks like milk.
It's milk, yes. So the rats receive a very special diet. It used to be that people could come, worshippers and tourists could come and feed the rats food they brought from outside the temple. But the caretakers of the rats decided that was not optimal for the rats' health. They were eating too much junk food. And so the rats now have a very special diet. They get their own homemade bread. They get bean sprouts. They get vegetables. And they drink lots of beautiful fresh milk that is brought in every single morning.
But traditionally, when we see rats, especially in a place like a kitchen or rummaging through the trash, running down the sidewalk, we feel this like instinctive disgust or this kind of recoil. We recoil from the rats.
Yeah. And it's interesting to note that that is a matter of context, right? We see rats often where we don't expect to see them, we're surprised. We see them in places that we've learned to associate with nasty things. For example, I talked with a bunch of scientists who actually study the psychology of disgust. And the idea is that the emotion of disgust evolved to protect us from these things that can make us sick. And so when we see a rat and we are disgusted, we have taken that emotion and expanded its context to an animal that we associate with sickness, that we say is pathogenic. And that makes us see them as disgusting. And in fact, we did not see rats in general as disgusting or unclean until the actual widespread proliferation of sewers, underground sewers. Before that, people did not like rats. Rats ate their crops and ate their grain. But they actually noted that rats always seemed to be really clean. And there was this idea that rats themselves did not spread disease. It was only with sewers and rats becoming coated in all sorts of unmentionable things that they became fully disgusting.
I guess rats, in the minds of many people, rats have been associated with spreading disease, with
plague.
Yeah, plague and those things.
Yes. And it's really fascinating because in my research, I found that most scientists who study plague will tell you bubonic plague is not a human disease. It is a rodent disease that happens to spill over into humans with very bad results. And that's because rats themselves do not go around biting people and spreading disease. It's spread by fleas, rat fleas, sometimes human lice, potentially human fleas. And there is some debate as to whether or not it's rat fleas themselves that caused things like the Black Death of the 14th century, or whether some of those outbreaks might have been caused by what are known as human ectoparasites, which would be human lice or human fleas. When you have large populations of people in close associations with large populations of rats, you absolutely can get disease spread, but you can get that from any other animal with which we are closely associated, including dogs, including chickens, including pigs. You know, rats are really no different.
Now, I've always heard that, you know, if you're going to have rats, you're not going to have mice. If you have mice, you're not going to have rats. Is there any truth to that?
You know, that's an interesting question. And there's some. Rats eat mice. They can eat mice. A rat in a fight with a mouse, the rat will win.
Yeah, that is, for sure.
There's no question. And so where you find rats, you are unlikely to find mice in that same area. Right? The mice are not interested in being where rats are. That means that where you find mice, there's probably not very many rats.
Now, you got to meet, you know, rats and mice in a different setting as a researcher. So, you know, I'm wondering if we can step away from the pest narrative for a moment to think about, you know, how they became to play such an important role in research.
That was really fascinating to me because, yes, I was a scientist and I did research primarily on mice, but also sometimes on rats. And it's really fascinating because the role of rats and mice as pests is part of what allowed them to become research subjects. It is because we don't like them that we feel okay doing the things that we need to do to learn about human disease. I studied a lot of this with the man who is primarily the man who sold the lab mouse to America. His name is C.C. Little, and he's the founder of the Jackson Laboratory, which is in Maine, and which many researchers think of as the House of Mouse. They are the world's largest purveyor of laboratory mice. And he started out breeding mice from original lines, and they were breeding these mice specifically for coat color. And scientists realized, oh, coat color is genetic. We can study genetics by breeding these mice. And they began to breed them and specifically to inbreed them until the mice all had the same genes, the same DNA. And so it became clear that we could use these mice to study human disease. And Little began to market the animals to other researchers and eventually to the public. And I found it really fascinating because in one of his articles that he actually wrote for Scientific American, he said, "Do you like mice? Of course you don't." And then he talked about the use of mice as scientific models. And he was selling the mouse to the American public as a laboratory model because it's something we could use to study humans, but it was also something that we didn't care about, that we hated. And that allowed us to use these animals the way that we use them today. I like to think that they're useful because they're just human enough to not be human at all.
You take readers on a trip to go snake hunting in the Everglades. So how did snakes in the first place become such a pest that they are now being hunted?
Yeah, so the snake that I was particularly in search of for this chapter was the Burmese python, Python vivitatus. And we actually are not 100% sure how pythons first got to the Everglades. They were definitely living wild there by the late 1970s. It could have been that people got pet pythons and released them when the pythons got too big, because pythons can be extraordinarily large. They can reach about 23 feet. So people might have, you know, freaked out and released their charges. Another option is hurricanes can destroy breeding facilities for these animals, which can release them into the swamp. It's possible that there was a combination of both of these things. Regardless, the Burmese python has found the Florida Everglades a fabulous place to live. Much like many retirees, the Burmese python thinks South Florida is great. And it is now eating a lot of the native residents. There was a study that I think was in 2012 showing that the population of rabbits in the Everglades has decreased by 100%. Raccoons were, I think, 90%, and other mammals were having higher than 50% declines. Pythons are eating the Everglades out of house and home.
And so people have started to hunt them? What does that entail?
Right. So I went out with Donna Collil. She is with the South Florida Water Management District. Her full-time job, actually, is that of a python hunter. That is her job.
Bethany joined Donna for the annual Florida Python Challenge. It's a 10-day competition to catch as many Burmese pythons as possible.
And it was a fascinating experience because you go out, it's the middle of the night, you are driving a levee in the Florida Everglades, okay? You are standing on top of a moving truck. Usually it's an SUV and there's a platform on top of the truck and you're standing up there while the truck is driving. And yeah, there is no security on this thing. And the truck itself is covered in floodlights. And the floodlights are lighting up the ground on either side of the levee. And the goal is for the lights to illuminate snakes that are coming out to cross the road. And it was amazing to me. First of all, I highly recommend this activity. It was magical. The Everglades at night are a wonderful, beautiful place, a magical moment. But also, pythons are ridiculously hard to see. They're so hard to see. You know, they're camouflaged, and every stick kind of looks like a snake. You know, they're incredibly hard to catch. And so it's fascinating because every year you'll get, you know, 800 or more hunters signing up for this python challenge, and they will bring in a total of 300 or so snakes. Less than one snake per person, right? And there are estimated to be tens of thousands of snakes in the Everglades.
And how do you, so you catch them and then you kill them, or what happens?
Right. So I did not catch them. Donna did. She's the specialist. So she usually goes up behind it. She has the fastest hands I have ever seen. And she just whips out a hand, gets it behind the head, and you know, for the python challenge, they usually log data, how big it is, where it was caught, things like that. They pop it in a box, and in the morning, they turn it in to event organizers. They do kill the snake. There are approved humane methods of killing snakes.
I asked Bethany how she felt about the hunt and what motivated the snake hunters, like Donna.
I was mostly just very interested to ask why, you know, why we're going in and doing this. What are we doing it for? And it was really fascinating. She's incredibly knowledgeable, and she really loves snakes. She loves native snakes who live in the Everglades, and she loves the Florida Everglades. And so she's out there removing this invasive species to preserve the Everglades that she knows, the swamp that she loves. And that's why she's doing it. And I think many of the other hunters have the same ideas in mind. And you see that a lot with a lot of invasive species removal. It's not just pythons. It's also, you know, invasive rats on islands, mice on islands, cats on islands, foxes, anywhere where humans have introduced animals that have started to, you know, cause real problems for the native fauna, you end up with conservationists faced with this dilemma. Do you kill the rats to save the seabirds? Do you kill the cats to save the native lizards? It's not a good question to ask, and it's also not a pleasant question to answer.
But it's going to be one or the other.
I mean, there are some options. So, for example, in some places, people, you know, trap, neuter, and return cats. They adopt them out. On many islands where the cats are fully feral, that is not a good option. That's really not going to save the animals that you're trying to save. In the case of rats or mice, they will often dump thousands of tons of poison on the islands in the hopes of removing the animals. There are controlled hunts. There are traps. There are also scientific experiments trying to, for example, develop genetic alterations in mice or rats that you can then introduce onto islands that will render the mice, say, sterile, so that the population of mice dies out more naturally to preserve the animals that are living there. No matter what, there's a lot of effort, time, and money put into getting rid of these animals because of the real or perceived problems that they're causing.
Bethany says climate change is often influencing or favoring the spread of different species into new territories.
Climate change is affecting drastically which animals can succeed and thrive in particular environments, right? And when animals begin to suffer from problems of climate change, we feel bad and we try to save them. Some animals are adapting and moving. So for example, as climate change makes some areas too warm, some animals that can move easily will start moving north, right, to find cooler weather. They'll try to find higher elevations. Animals that are used to wet areas will try to find wetter areas if their area becomes dry. And what's fascinating is that we then call those animals climate refugees, right? If they're native animals and they're moving somewhere else, we call them climate refugees. If they're an animal that we've introduced and they're succeeding in part due to climate change, we call them pests.
Yeah.
And the difference is that we wanted one of them and we didn't want the other one. But yes, climate change is only going to change which animals thrive where and how. It introduces another kind of chaos element into how ecosystems function. It brings ecosystems into further stress where animals that we introduce can often outcompete other native fauna that might otherwise have managed to make it.
What do you want people to take away from reading your book? What is the one big message that you hope people will get after they read your book?
I would say it's in two parts. The first is that pests are a matter of perspective. We create every single pest we have because pests are about what we want and what we believe about our environments. And the second part of that is that we don't have to live this way. We created pests. We can destroy them too. And we don't need to destroy them by going out and killing them all. We can change what we call pests by changing our perspective, by changing the way we live with these animals. Do we really need to eradicate all the pigeons? Or do we need to change how we deal with our trash? Do we need to go poisoning rats? Or do we need to change our sanitation? When we have problems with animals, we're very quick to blame the animal. But we could also look to our own behavior and change how we think and how we act.
Bethany Brookshire is a science writer. Her new book is called Pests: How Humans Create Animal Villains.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about pests. Here's one that I hate. Mosquitoes. They love me, and I get bitten all of the time. Mosquitoes can ruin a backyard barbecue, a nice walk in the park, and worse than that, their bites can spread diseases. But in some ways, you almost have to admire them, the way they procreate.
They actually mate in flight.
They can breed pretty much anywhere.
A bottle cap that fills with rainwater.
They can survive a cold winter.
They produce a lot of sugar in their cells that works like antifreeze, and so it prevents them from freezing.
This is mosquito researcher Laura Harrington. She's an entomologist at Cornell University. Of course, the main thing we notice about mosquitoes, what makes them such a pest, is that they bite us. There are about 3,500 different species of mosquitoes, and only a few of them actually feed on humans. But they end up spreading some of the worst diseases all over the world.
All mosquito viruses are transmitted in the saliva. So mosquitoes have salivary glands, and the viruses are injected into the host in the saliva when the mosquito feeds.
Mosquitoes can spread illnesses like dengue fever, West Nile virus, Zika, yellow fever, or malaria.
It was right around the 1900s when scientists first started to put the pieces of the puzzle together and realized that mosquitoes were actually directly transmitting pathogens.
And ever since then, we've been in a serious battle to kill lots of them, to reduce their numbers. And that is a lot of work. In 2020, Alan Yu talked to a researcher who is keeping mosquito populations in check, but she actually really likes these insects.
Entomologist Autumn Angelus kills mosquitoes that try to bite her, like the rest of us. But before she slaps, she'll look to see what kind it is first. And she is always looking for mosquitoes. We're trudging through muddy puddles at Elmer Lake Wildlife Management Area in New Jersey, trying to find mosquito larvae in the dirty, tea-colored water sitting stagnant on the ground.
I think I just saw a mosquito. Oh, no. No. Darn.
Wait, were you disappointed that that wasn't actually a mosquito?
Yeah, I'm always disappointed. You know, I'm always looking for mosquito larvae. I'm always looking for mosquitoes. Even when we went to Disney World, I was checking the bromeliads for mosquito larvae.
She studies insects and specializes in mosquitoes. And though she likes them, part of her job is to keep them in check. She works for Salem County Mosquito Control in New Jersey.
I find them very fascinating, so I'm always looking for them.
She almost always has an aspirator, a mosquito-catching device in her purse. She also has a dipper, which is a plastic ladle connected to a long stick. She scoops up ladles of water and peers inside for wriggling young mosquitoes.
Yay! Larvae! So there's a whole bunch of larvae in here, and there's several different instars.
An instar is a growth stage for the larvae. They look like tiny black dots attached to hyperactive tails.
More of the same in here. Yeah, this is a busy little puddle here.
She also collects some of the water with the mosquito larvae in a plastic bag, so she can try and raise them back in her lab. Another part of her job is to go through whatever gets caught in various insect traps in strategic locations to stay on top of what mosquitoes are active.
It can get very tedious and messy because the other insect scales tend to get everywhere. So sometimes you're blowing your nose and you have insect parts that come out.
She's been working in mosquito control for more than a decade, since she was 18. That's when she met the one, the mosquito that got her into mosquitoes.
This is Taxorhynchites rutilus. That is my favorite. And yes, she's a very good mosquito. Its common name is the elephant mosquito. And that's because of this long curved proboscis. So it kind of looks like an elephant trunk.
That shape means they do not drink blood. She worked with the entomologist at the time to feed their larvae and raise them into adults.
The first time I saw an adult and its brilliant colors, its green and yellow and blue colors, I was just amazed. So after that, I kind of went searching for them, and every time I found one, I would keep it and I would rear it out, and I never really grasped the gravity of how wonderful they are until I was really caring for them and trying to colonize them because they're so specific and they're so picky.
For example, these mosquitoes mate while they fall through the sky. The female lays her eggs one at a time by dive bombing them into holes in trees. Autumn and another entomologist in Texas are trying to raise these mosquitoes because their larvae will actually eat other mosquito larvae, so they could potentially be used to kill mosquitoes that spread diseases like West Nile virus or Eastern equine encephalitis. And that's her job too, to test mosquitoes to see what viruses they have and keep the disease-spreading mosquito populations down.
Most people in mosquito control are very passionate about what we do, and it's just unfortunate that we kind of get ignored. We're like the redheaded stepchild of the government departments. Even just trying to get the word out there that we exist is difficult.
Have you seen the show Parks and Recreation?
Yeah, yep.
Did they have a mosquito person in there?
No, they didn't, and it's very disappointing. No, they didn't. I was really hopeful. It is funny that you bring that up, though, because my husband always says that I'm the Leslie Knope of mosquito control, because I'm, like, always so excited about it.
Mosquitoes, of course, have been living in the marshlands and plains of New Jersey long before any humans came. They've figured out every place where they could live.
They're very successful creatures.
This story was reported by Alan Yu in 2020. Autumn is still working in mosquito control. She still does field work, but now she also coordinates mosquito control with New Jersey state and federal agencies. Part of what makes it so hard to keep mosquito populations at bay is that they are so good at surviving. For example, cold winters. It's like the second it warms up, they are back. I talked about that with Cornell entomologist Laura Harrington.
That is one feature for temperate mosquitoes that is really fascinating. So they've been able to survive very cold winters. And oftentimes people will notice that they'll have mosquitoes biting in the fall, and then it'll come winter, the mosquitoes disappear. Where are they? Well, they're actually hibernating, and they have different strategies that they use to hibernate. And what they do is they produce a lot of sugar in their cells that works like antifreeze, and so it prevents them from freezing. And so some survive the winter in the egg stage, in tiny little eggs under the snowpack. Some will survive as immature stages. They're actually frozen in blocks of ice. And then some will overwinter as adults, and they'll come into human houses, into basements and sheds, and spend the winter there in a sheltered environment. They basically just shut down their metabolism through the winter, and then they're ready to go when it warms up again in the spring.
Female mosquitoes lay hundreds of eggs. So if you want to reduce mosquito populations around your house, you have to keep your eyes out for places where they breed. And remember, that space could be the size of a bottle cap.
A couple of things you can do, and it's important for homeowners to practice searching for standing water around their property and then trying to remove the standing water. So in containers, like the bases of plant pots, can dump those out on a weekly basis. Recycling bins, you can drill holes in them so that the water drains out. And if you do it once a week, that interferes with the completion of the mosquito life cycle in most of the time. There are also some bacterial biopesticides that people can buy at hardware stores, and those are completely safe to people, even to other insects.
Now, I always say that mosquitoes just terrorize me, and I get bitten so many times, a lot more than many other people. Is there any truth to that, that some people just attract mosquitoes where others don't?
There is some truth to that, and that's a big question that nobody's really been able to figure out completely. It's complicated, and part of the complication is that as humans, we emit hundreds of compounds that individually have been shown to be attractive to mosquitoes. So it's really people with the ideal blend of these hundreds of compounds that are probably more attractive than others. And so there are people who've spent decades working on this to try to understand the optimal blend of those odors.
Laura Harrington is a professor in the Department of Entomology at Cornell University in New York and the director of the Northeast Regional Center for Excellence in Vector-Borne Diseases. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, one man's epic battle to get a sneaky intruder out of his aquarium.
Every time I pulled it, it would come out a little bit, and it just kept coming out. It was kind of disgusting.
That's next on The Pulse.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about pests. Earlier on, science writer Bethany Brookshire said, what makes a pest is all about context. If the animal shows up somewhere, they are not wanted.
These animals aren't attacking us. They're attacking our stuff.
For Don Arndt, the stuff was his beautiful aquarium, which he's had for decades. It's his pride and joy, and it really functions like an ecosystem, complete with what's called a live rock that introduces all kinds of microorganisms into the water. In Don's case, it might have also introduced something else, a sand striker or bobbit worm, which usually lives in the sand at the bottom of the ocean.
So a bobbit worm looks like a giant centipede. I more likened it to the sand creatures in Dune. So it's got these tentacles that stick out, and it's kind of multicolored. It's quite disgusting.
Don wanted this creature out of his tank, and what ensued was nothing short of an epic battle. Liz Tung has this story.
The first thing to know about Don is that he's a total aquarium nerd. He started keeping fish when he was just a kid.
And I've always had one ever since, much to my wife's dismay.
Don has a saltwater aquarium, which is a ton of work. Picture a real-life version of the Little Mermaid. Gorgeous coral, brightly colored tropical fish. It is exquisite. And for almost 30 years, it's been a big part of Don's life, not to mention his house.
So it's a 150-gallon saltwater reef tank, and it's 4 feet wide, 2 feet deep, and then just about 3 feet tall.
In other words, it's huge. The aquarium's technically located in Don's garage, but he cut a hole in the wall between his garage and his house, so it looks like a picture hanging on the wall. And for all this time, it's been a source of beauty and relaxation for Don, until one fateful night in 2009, when Don spotted something strange.
One of my corals, something bit a big hole in it and scurried off into the rocks. And that's how this whole nightmare started.
At the time, not many people knew about bobbit worms, but what they'd heard was bad. For one thing, they're hideous.
So a bobbit worm looks like a giant centipede. It's got these tentacles that stick out, and it's kind of multicolored.
They grow incredibly fast and incredibly big.
They can grow to 11 feet long. This particular one that I had was about 3/4 of an inch around.
About the diameter of a quarter. They're also ambush predators. They burrow into the sand and then shoot out with razor-sharp jaws capable of slicing fish in half.
And the thing could disappear in a fraction of a second. They're so fast.
Worst of all, they're destructive.
They literally eat everything. I observed him one night eating stony coral, which is basically calcium, like an ear of corn. He was just chewing it right off. They eat fish. They eat everything.
One of the things that was most disturbing to Don is that the worm had probably been living in his tank for more than 10 years by the time he noticed it. Don's guessing it rode its way into the tank in the live rock that he'd installed in his aquarium back in 1996. Which means it was probably just a little baby worm when it first arrived. 13 years later, Don was guessing it had grown to around 2 to 3 feet, all of which it was able to hide, slinky-like, in a 1-inch hole in the aquarium's live rock.
It literally was like all through the rocks. It tunnels through rocks. It literally can eat rock, which is amazing.
Don had no idea how to get this thing out of the rock it was living in. And there was no way to get the rock out of the aquarium. It weighed 90 pounds dry. Soaked with water and covered in coral, Don says it probably weighed almost 300 pounds. Plus, it had become an integral part of the tank's ecosystem.
There's just no way to get it out without totally destroying the whole aquarium.
No one else Don talked to knew what to do either. So instead, Don turned to an ancient tome of wisdom.
The Art of War.
That's right, the famous military treatise written in 5th century BC by Sun Tzu, source of the famous quote, "Keep your friends close and your enemies closer." So Don decided he would start off by befriending the bobbit worm.
So I started feeding it every night. They're nocturnal mostly. And I would stay up all night waiting for it to stick its little head out. And then I would feed it shrimp. And so it got used to coming out every single night at the same time. And I would feed it every night at the same time. And then I started the war.
Don's first plan of attack was a plot worthy of a Shakespearean drama. He would poison the worm.
So my first plan was, once I got it eating shrimp, I would inject the shrimp with copper, which is poison to most aquatic animals, and then feed it a copper-laden shrimp, and then hopefully it would die.
And so, okay, so you would lower the shrimp down with tongs. It would, like, shoot out and get the shrimp, and then it ate the shrimp with a copper in it, obviously, right?
For several nights, yes.
And what happened?
Nothing. It just kept coming back for more.
So Don moved on to his second scheme.
Interceptor, which is a dog heartworm pill, which we also use in the saltwater aquarium world to rid these pests called red bugs that eat coral and kill your coral.
So each night, Don would stuff half a pill inside the shrimp and feed it to the worm.
And what happened when you did that?
Nothing. I did it for three nights in a row. And then I waited, and he kept coming back every night.
Could you see him growing bigger as you were feeding him shrimp?
He was getting bolder, which I was also encouraging, like pulling it out a little bit further to see how far. At this point, I didn't know how big he was.
If the worm was long enough, Don was hoping, maybe he could lure it out just far enough to grab it with the tongs and yank it out.
And then I did some reading, and they said if you break it in half, you will have two because it's a segmented worm, so it'll grow a new head.
So that was a no-go, as was tack number two, the deworming pill.
Yeah, the interceptor did not work. So then I got really creative.
On to Don's third plan of attack, feeding the bobbit worm a shrimp filled with super glue.
I thought if it ate it, it would bite into it and glue its mouth closed. So I literally hollowed out a shrimp shell and filled it full of super glue and fed him that.
After the first night, Don thought he had him. The worm ate the super glue shrimp and then disappeared for a couple days. But pretty soon, he was back.
He came back every night. I think it was four or five times I gave it a try. It still didn't work.
By this time, Don was getting desperate. In addition to his own morbid experiments, he turned to an online aquarium forum for help. And his post generated a ton of interest. They've actually become kind of legendary.
I believe we've named it the Bobbit Worm Chronicles because it went on for so long.
Anyway, Don says he thinks a lot of the interest was because this was such a new phenomenon, a problem even professional aquariums hadn't cracked yet.
Plus, the thing is just so disgusting. You know, it's like watching a car crash.
And it was a delicate problem to solve. Anything that could kill the bobbit worm could potentially kill Don's other fish. He'd taken a risk with the liquid copper and the interceptor pills. And he couldn't just grab the worm because it was so cautious. It would only come far enough out of the rock to eat and then dart back in the blink of an eye. Don needed something that would physically kill the worm, not just poison it. Everyone on the forum had their own ideas.
Someone on the thread suggested glass, so I ground up glass, mixed it with super glue and put it in there. That didn't work either. I think the second time I fed him shards of glass, like quarter-inch shards of glass. And he did disappear for a few days, actually almost a week, I think. And then I happened to stroll by the aquarium. I thought he was dead, and I saw him out eating one of my corals. So he was back.
At this point, Don was about 3 weeks into his war against the bobbit worm, and he was starting to lose it.
I was mad, frustrated that I couldn't get the thing out. So I wasn't sleeping at night because I would have to get up at 3 a.m. to feed the thing. And then I was just, yeah, very frustrated, extremely frustrated.
Don had been driven to the edge of his sanity. He'd been staying up half the night for weeks, guarding his tank. He'd fed the worm copper, super glue, and broken glass, all with no effect. Clearly, he needed to do something drastic. Go to hand-to-hand combat with the worm.
I finally was like, okay, I'm just going to fish this thing out like it was a fish.
So one night, around feeding time, Don baited a fishing hook with some shrimp and lowered it into the tank.
And he swallowed it whole, and I had him, and it was, I've fished off the Florida Keys. I've had some epic fish battles, but This one went on for, I don't remember. I think it was like 40 minutes.
So it's 2:30 in the morning, and Don is standing on top of his tank in his garage, trying to pull this thing out. At the time, Don had speculated that the worm was maybe 2 to 3 feet long, but as it kept unfurling, this segmented beast covered in dozens of legs, he realized it had reached horrifying proportions.
And every time I pulled it, it would come out a little bit, and it just kept coming out. It was kind of disgusting.
It was strong, but Don was stronger. And then it happened. The bobbit worm snapped. Don stumbled backwards. He watched with horror as the remaining section of the worm darted back into its rock.
And I was left with a 2-foot section of brown grossness.
So was that first section still alive?
It was wiggling around on the floor, yes. I just bagged it up and threw it away.
The worst part? Somehow, Don had ended up with the back end of the worm.
I looked at it and I was like, oh, there's no head. How did I catch the back end?
Knowing what he knew about bobbit worms' ability to regenerate, Don was sure the worm would soon be back to its old tricks. So he kept watch. A day went by, then another, and another. A week, 10 days. No bobbit worm. Maybe it really had died. Don was just starting to relax, just starting to accept that maybe this whole hellish journey was finally over, when he spotted him.
I saw him in the middle of the night eating a very beautiful bright blue sponge that I had.
Don watched with rage as the worm chomped away at his sponge. But then something lucky happened. The worm left his usual hideout, the giant rock, and crawled into a smaller one. Don knew this was his chance. Maybe his only chance.
And I pulled that rock out, dragged it out of my driveway at 3 o'clock in the morning and started busting it up. First, I tried spraying hot water inside its hole to see if it would come out. It did not. So I picked up the rock and broke it, and then it came crawling out, all 5 feet of it.
5 feet. And remember, Don had already snapped off another 2 feet of this thing.
Did you scream?
I believe I swore and then was jumping for joy and trying to take videos of the thing.
You'd think, after everything the bobbit worm put Don through, he'd want to destroy it right away. But he didn't. Instead, he chucked it in a bucket full of water and the next day called a friend who worked at the local pet store. The friend told Don to bring it in.
So when you finally got it out, did you feel any connection at all to the bobbit worm? You'd been through so much together, you know?
Oddly enough, there was a little bit of me that was like, wow, you know, a little bit, maybe. Maybe. I guess maybe that's why I didn't kill it right away. Plus, I didn't know how to kill it, to be honest. I mean, this thing had just survived everything I could think of.
The worm lived for a while on display at the pet shop, a warning to other aquarium owners of what might be lurking in their tanks.
I did go look at it a few times, yes. He didn't recognize me. But the weird thing was, so this thing is 5 feet long at this point, and they put it in a little tank with these little rocks, maybe 3 inches, 4 inches, and that thing would hide in those rocks. Like, I don't know how it did it. They're an amazing creature, that's all I can say. They will be around long after us.
But the worm didn't end up staying a de facto pet. In the end, they put him in a jar of formaldehyde and gave him to a local biology student. And Don's aquarium has been fine ever since. All that's left of his encounter is the forum thread, which gets shared around every few months. And Don's memories of his epic war with a creature from the deep.
This was a battle. But I won.
That story was reported by Liz Tong. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tong, and Grant Hill. Marcus Biddle is our Health Equity Fellow. Alan Hinnich is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Nicole Curry is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.